From the WVXU studios, this is Cincinnati Edition.
The greater good is not for this portion of our neighborhood to yield to building this development so children from other states and countries arrive in our neighborhood to be healed. Is this a reason to destroy more of Avondale to build for the sickest children?
Ultimately, this was a medical decision. And yet, I appreciate the concerns expressed by some of our neighbors and fellow citizens, especially in Avondale.
Avondale Community Council President Patricia Milton and Children's Hospital CEO Michael Fisher as the debate continues over expanding the hospital. I'm Mark Haney. Our panel of journalists joins us for our weekly review of local news today. First up, WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn with the latest on the opioid crisis in our region. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Lisa. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, the opioid crisis is taking an even more dangerous turn with this influx of synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and carfentanil. How bad is this getting? I mean, how many people are overdosing? How many people are losing their lives to this?
Yeah, thousands are overdosing across Southwest Ohio. Hundreds are losing their lives. And what we hear from public health officials and law enforcement is that, you know, we're on pace in Ohio for the deadliest year relative to opioid overdoses. And unfortunately, because of this rapid flow of synthetic opioids coming into our communities, there's this feeling that maybe we haven't seen the worst of it yet.
Yeah, Ohio Senator Rob Portman is somebody you spoke to, and he said that Ohio's rate of overdose deaths is nearly double the national average. Is that right?
That's right. And unfortunately, we've sort of been in that number one, number two ranking for several years now. And the scariest piece of this is now that we know that fentanyl and carfentanil are so accessible and so readily available in our communities, there's a real fear about what this could mean in terms of how rapidly our overdose death count will continue to spike. We have seen some relief here in recent months, but, you know, it was this time last year that carfentanil first really hit the radar for law enforcement and first discovered that carfentanil was entering the heroin supply. And carfentanil is this elephant tranquilizer that's, you know, 10,000 times more potent than heroin. And it really caught the DEA, it caught law enforcement off guard in terms of just the powerful, how powerful this drug is and how deadly it is. And so we've been sort of steadily marching at this pace of dozens of overdoses, you know, upwards of 70 overdoses in Southwest Ohio a week, increasing numbers of overdose deaths because these drugs are so powerful and deadly.
How effective is Narcan with these drugs?
So Narcan is effective, but increasingly they have to use more Narcan.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've talked to, you know, first responders who say, I can't recall the last time I used one dose of Narcan on an individual. It's multiple doses, 4 and 5 and 6. And if it's an individual who has carfentanil in their system, we're talking about it's 4 or 5, you know, doses initially. And then there's a half-life of the drug that you have to go back and keep monitoring this individual because the drug sort of resurfaces, so to speak, in their system, and you have to go back and revive them again.
Are there any particular parts of the tri-state area, Lisa, that are more affected by this than other parts?
Unfortunately, there is no zip code that is untouched by this. We did an analysis where we took nearly a year's worth of overdose death data, overdose data, and tried to zero in on those areas where the drugs seem to be having the deadliest impact. We found that Butler County, certain zip codes in Butler County, have certainly seen the most overdose deaths. And these are zip codes that include the city of Hamilton, Middletown, and Monroe. And maybe some will recall, you know, Butler County is the same area where the sheriff there, Richard Jones, has denied to equip his deputies with Narcan. We don't know what that correlation is, but we know that that's a fact, and we know what numbers we're seeing there.
Why is our area so hard hit? I mean, what do we have any ideas? What's bringing this on?
I think when you talk to individuals who have been up keeping track of this epidemic and its evolution over the last decade, they will say, we know that Ohio Southwest Ohio especially was a prime spot for pill mills, so to speak. So these were pain management clinics that were set up where opioids were largely being prescribed to just about anyone who would walk in the door. Most of those got shut down in Ohio, and some will tell you that opened the door for the cartels to come in and start selling cheap heroin.
Where are they coming from?
So the drugs themselves, this is the other scary piece of this epidemic. You can, when it comes to fentanyl or carfentanil, it's places what they call the dark web or sometimes even a simple Google search. You can go online. You can find a source for your very powerful opioid. It's coming from illegal clinics or labs, rather, in China and Canada and being shipped through the mail.
What's going on as far as the we were talking about first responders earlier. What's going on as far as the impact on them?
So, you know, when we see spikes of overdoses in certain communities, our first responders are going nonstop. And what they tell us is some of the most concerning, a really concerning piece of this is they are responding to the same individuals over and over again. So these are, you know, individuals that sometimes it's reviving somebody three times in one day. And so there's a real concern about how, and there's an effort underway to better understand this population of individuals who are repeatedly overdosing. And the question is, what can we do with them? We're talking about sort of a small amount of people who are responsible for a large number of overdoses.
So for those folks, should they be required to undergo rehabilitation?
There are some, here in greater Cincinnati, that discussion is underway. The question is, for these individuals who are repeatedly overdosing, should they be forced into some kind of treatment? What can we do about them? And there is an examination of, you know, state law. Is there any state law on the books that would allow us to do this? Casey's Law, some might recall, is a law on the books that allows a family member or an individual to go through a court process to admit somebody into treatment. It's a very expensive process. And in Ohio, families have to pay, you know, all of their court fees and treatment costs up front. And it hasn't been very successful in getting people into treatment. There's some individuals who are saying, you know, maybe we could use this method that we call pink slipping, which is really another term for a mental health hold. So if somebody in Ohio is a danger to themselves or a danger to others because of their mental health state, they can be admitted to a mental health facility for up to 72 hours. And then a judge will have to determine what that next step is for them. And so some are questioning, do these individuals sort of fall into that category? And is there a way to at least temporarily put them into some setting that keeps them safe, that lightens the load on first responders and helps that individual get to that next step that may be treatment or medication-assisted treatment, something that keeps them from overdosing again?
We also had the council member in Middletown who asked the more pointed, specific question, how often do we keep reviving people who are overdosing?
That's right. So the reason why folks are looking at this population of repeat overdoses is it's an enormous burden in terms of the financial cost. we're looking at the city of Cincinnati, for example, spent more than $100,000 on Narcan last year. The small city of Middletown, this Middletown councilman, I think, was alleging had already spent $100,000 this year on Narcan. So there's a question of resources. You know, are we at some point in the future going to run out of resources to help these individuals who continually overdose? And that's, I think that's the question that he was sort of throwing out there, a three strikes and you're out. You know, he was asking the question, if an individual has overdosed three times, do we have to respond to them? Because they are putting enormous burden on our first responders, on our financial resources, and one day we're going to run out of money or people.
Yeah, in terms of Narcan itself, I mean, how is the supply holding up? I mean, what's this doing to the supply? What's this doing to the price of the drug?
Yeah, as far as we know, there isn't a concern about the supply, at least none that I have heard. The state has been very forthcoming with funding Narcan for communities that maybe don't have access to it otherwise through various grant programs. But we know the cost of the drug has continued to go up as more and more communities need it. I think right now a single dose is about $32. Looking at sort of the practices of the pharmaceutical industry, one could surmise that's a price that's going to continue to rise.
You know, Lisa, we had two Cincinnati police officers, two separate incidents, who were exposed to some substance. I don't know if they ever determined whether it was actually a synthetic opioid or not, but they were exposed to something, ended up in the hospital, and fortunately, they're doing fine. But how big a concern is this for police officers and first responders as far as the effects it could have on them physically?
You know, and I think that's the other piece of this. When you talk about those individuals who are frequently overdosing, or just any individual, a first responder who has to go to a scene, there's incredible risk to those individuals. We know these drugs are 50 to 10,000 times more powerful than heroin. So if you're a first responder on the scene, you're now taking on all kinds of new practices to guard yourself against coming in contact with these substances that are deadly. And so that's another enormous burden just on sort of the job itself, but then the additional cost it takes to protect our first responders.
So what else is underway to deal with this, Lisa? I mean, what else is out there?
You know, I think that this effort here in Cincinnati to look at this overdose population is really unique, and it's probably going to start getting attention in other communities. That to me is, if you think about other areas of health, for example, where there have been this question of, okay, we have a small population of people who are really exacting large cost on the healthcare system. For example, like the emergency rooms, we have, you know, the frequent flyer to the emergency rooms. There's been real effort in recent decades to understand who are these frequent flyers coming to the emergency room for things like common cold, et cetera, because they're coming to a place where the care is the most expensive. So it's a few amount of individuals who are having an enormous burden on the overall system. If you can get your arms around this frequent overdose population. We know the numbers in Cincinnati, at least for a portion. We're talking about 60% of the overdose calls are to individuals who have overdosed two times or more. You can really cut down on the number of emergency runs you're making, therefore you're having an impact on costs. To me, that's really the most innovative thing that I've seen in recent, really in the last year, as people begin to figure out new ways to tackle this.
I keep hearing this called an epidemic. Is that a fair term? Do you think that's a correct term for this?
I think public health officials will tell you, yes, it's a fair and correct term. Crisis is another, emergency is another term that we've heard thrown out. The fact of the matter is, in Ohio, it probably doesn't matter what you call it. I think everybody's trying to figure out, okay, so what are the solutions?
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn. Next up, the continuing debate over expansion plans for Cincinnati Children's Hospital. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of the news, and joining us now, WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Bill and Jay, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Good afternoon. To see both of you. Happy to be here.
Now, last week, Jay, we got word of this plan that would make some major changes to MSD, turn over the day-to-day operations to a five-member citizens panel. Where do things stand with that? Has that made any progress at this point?
There's a lot of discussion about what they're going to do. I think there's going to be some tinkering with the agreement, but as far as any votes, those haven't happened yet. And from the sound of the talks at City Hall, county officials have to have some documents to send to bonding agencies, I think on August the 15th, and it sounds like that the city council could run them right down to the wire, and not if they're going to approve it, it could come as late as August the 14th.
Yeah. Bill, where's the county stand on this?
They've got two of the three commissioners on board with the MSD change. Todd Portune and Denise Driehaus are both in favor of it, and Republican Chris Monzel, not a big fan.
And city-wise, we know that there are three definitely for it. There are three who have announced opposition, so that leaves three undecided. And my hunch is that when push comes to shove, it'll probably be approved by the city 5-4. Now, that's subject to change. I've been wrong many times before, but there are two maybes that I think are leaning yes. They want some more. They want some slight changes to the document, which I think they're going to be able to get, and that'll bring them on for a 5-4 city council vote.
And Bill, the opposition on commission is Chris Munzel, is that right?
Yes.
What's his concern about this?
Well, he's not a big fan of the way it's set up. He says it doesn't answer directly to ratepayers. It would be a five member panel that would oversee the operations at MSD. Three of those would be appointed by the county, two appointed by the city. It would take a supermajority of four members to hire or fire the director or assistant director. And Munzel says they're not directly answerable to ratepayers. He doesn't care so much for that. He doesn't he's not a big fan of keeping the MSD employees on the Cincinnati retirement system. And he had another hesitation, I think the speed at which this is all being pushed through gives him a little pause as well.
Yeah, but,
and that's some of the concern at City Hall too, is the speed at which this thing is happening. And it's speedy to the people who haven't known about it, but we found out after this agreement was, or I've got to be careful, it's not an agreement yet.
A letter was
introduced, that there actually have been closed-door negotiations taking place for 13 months. So it's not to the parties.
It's not like this just suddenly popped up.
Right. It's,
okay.
It's not new to the people who helped negotiate it, but to everybody else who's going to have to approve it, it is relatively new. Right. And there's also, it's not lost that there are some important timing here, not only for the county for these bond documents on August the 15th, but there is the realization that the makeup of city council and also the city's mayor could be different on January, I believe it's 2nd of this year, January 2nd or 3rd, whenever the new council and mayor is sworn in. There is a mayor's race. The incumbent mayor could lose, and there will be three new council members, and that could change the dynamic of council substantially.
It was pointed out earlier this week that those closed-door negotiations you mentioned, they started 13 months ago, but they didn't last for 13 months. So they took 3 months off, October, November, December. And then the county in January, the county commissioners voted to restart the talks. So there was a bit of a gap there. And
well, they were contemplating.
I'm not exactly sure why. I, looking at the timing, I'm wondering if the elections had something to do with that. People were kind of focused on elections and campaigning.
Are the details of this plan set in stone, Jay, or is it possible that this whole thing could get altered along the way again?
I've heard both ways. I've heard, yes, it can be altered, and then I've heard, no, it can't be altered. My guess is, basically, as Bill, that's why I'm hesitant to call it an agreement. Basically, it's a letter saying we will do
it. Is it a letter of intent, maybe?
Right, it's okay. A letter of intent, and it's saying we will do these things in an agreement that has to come later. So I think that there is some room to make changes, but ultimately, I guess that would be up to the federal judge. If this was the letter that was given to him and there are substantial changes, I would assume that he would maybe want to have some input on that. The other thing that I still haven't gotten a clear answer to is, as I said, there could be political change the first of the year at City Hall. You can approve this letter, but what happens if the agreement is not done by that timeline? And I would assume that the county and the city would also have to approve that agreement.
And that's the mid-August date that you're talking about, right?
August 15th.
August 15th. Okay, and the concern here is the bond rating.
Yes, the agencies that determine a community's bond rating, how much they can, well, basically it's when you go to set a bond, these agencies determine at what rating you're at, and then people determine how much they're going to charge interest and all of that.
It's your credit worthiness.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just basically it's the same thing as an individual credit score. The higher your credit score,
the less you're
going to pay for interest rates.
The better the interest rate you'll get.
The county is looking for, if your individual credit score, you want something 750 or higher, that's kind of what the county is looking for.
If I'm paying my sewer bill in Hamilton County, Jay, should I be jumping up and down about this? Should I be saying, oh, goody, this great plan is coming? Or
I think that's hard to say, because what's driving the sewer rate increases is the federal consent decree to fix the problems with the sewer system. That's not going away. And I know there are some cost savings that they point out, that the county will no longer need its independent monitoring. They're not going to be fighting each other, which will save on legal fees. But I don't know what the total MSD budget is. But I think the number I've heard was like $4 or $5 million a year on these side, the legal fees and monitoring. So based on the MSD budget, yes, there'll be some cost savings, but is it enough to drive a huge rate decrease, or the rate increases won't be as much? I'm just not sure that the jury's returned on that one yet.
Yeah, this letter would set up the arrangement would last for 45 years, and that number is not just plucked out of thin air. That's essentially how long the consent decree is going to be before that's all taken care of. So this would wrap up, and we'd have to renew or find another way to govern MSD.
Well, the projects won't take 45 years. What they're planning on is the projects will be done, but it'll be bonded probably for 30 years. So they have this, the 45 years pays off through the, should have all the bonds paid off for the money they had to borrow to do all this consent decree work.
Now, Jay, City Council also, there was supposed to be a vote on several ordinances this week that would have allowed.
They were supposed to do a lot of things.
They were supposed to do a lot of things, but they didn't get to them. This would have allowed Children's Hospital to move forward on its $650 million in expansion plans. So it didn't happen?
Well, no, it didn't happen. The Neighborhoods Committee is responsible. Some of these are zoning issues. The Neighborhoods Committee is responsible for approving the zoning issues, and there are four members on the committee. And at the meeting on Tuesday, Vice Mayor Mann and Councilmember Flynn were there, but Councilmembers Simpson and Young were excused, so they didn't have a quorum. They needed at least three to take a vote. They only had two. So they were going to reschedule for Wednesday, same situation. Vice Mayor Mann, Councilmember Flynn were available. Councilmember Simpson and Young were not, so they still couldn't vote. So the plan right now is for there to be a special Neighborhoods Committee meeting on Monday morning at 11 o'clock. They do have assurances. I'm told that Councilmember Young says he is available for that meeting, so they would have their three for the meeting at least, and could pass these on to City Council. Then Council itself on Wednesday had three members absent, Simpson, Young, and Councilmember Winburn. And because of a quirk in state law, generally ordinances have to be read on three different days. But normally what council does is suspend that rule, but state law says it takes 3/4 of the council members to do that. Well, that's seven. There were only six there, so they couldn't vote on any of the ordinances that were on the agenda. So they're going to try to have a meeting this coming Wednesday to basically finish the work that they couldn't do this Wednesday. Are you confused?
Yeah. I guess the main question I have is any thought that these absences were intentional?
There's speculation on that, and nobody will comment. I sent a text to Council Member Young asking about his absence and got no response. His office said that he was out of town Wednesday, and it's possible he was out of town just that day, because Tuesday evening I'm told that he was at Police District 2's night out events, and then yesterday he was at a Chamber of Commerce council member meet and greet that was held in their lobby, because there were pictures on social media where he was there for that event. So there was some speculation that maybe they're trying to delay the vote on Children's Hospital, but it would seem that they're just delaying the inevitable. By all indications, there are six council members who are willing to vote in favor of that and let it move forward.
And that's
more than enough.
Meantime, you have the argument continuing. Avondale, a lot of people saying we're opposed to this. And
Avondale says it will not be good for their neighborhood. Children saying they're out of space. And the way that the hospital and the campus is set up now, it makes sense to go this way and build essentially over top of Erkenbrecker Avenue.
And Bill, Hamilton County Commission approved a new policy agenda at their meeting this week. So what's this cover?
This is the 2018 policy agenda, and it basically sets out a roadmap for where the commissioners, two of three of the commissioners, want the county government to be heading in. Chris Monzel voted against this. Denise Driehaus, Todd Portune both said yes. There are 11 areas ranging from stabilizing county finances to economic growth to fostering more inclusion in the county. There are goals for setting investments for transportation infrastructure. There's goals for dealing with the heroin epidemic, environmental sustainability. It's basically a wish list and saying this is where we want the county to be going. And Chris Monzel said, well, it's a little aspirational and we really can't afford a lot of these things. Denise Driehaus said, yeah, it's aspirational, but we do need to have some goals. We need to, you know, maybe we not hit all of these, but we need to be thinking about where we want to go. And yeah, we should have aspirations is her argument.
And of course, as you're pointing out, this all depends a lot on how the county budget turns out. And how's it shaping up so far?
Well, sales tax revenue is down. Number of revenue has taken a bit of a dip, down $2.2 million for the rest of the year. The county administrator, Jeff Aluto, he's found some ways to adjust for that. He's also hoping the sales tax revenue will rebound. He believes it's just kind of a fluke, he said. Well, he didn't use the word fluke, but he believes this is just, you know, a strange dip for whatever reason. He's hoping the tax revenues will rebound and things will look good for the rest of the year. But in the meantime, he's instituted kind of a soft hiring freeze.
No layoffs, though, right?
No layoffs. Okay. No layoffs. Telling county officials that if you've got a position open and you really need to hire someone, hesitate on it. You know, maybe put it off if you can, but don't be going hiring willy-nilly. Kind of a soft hiring freeze. He's instituted some cuts, non-personnel cuts across the county, just trying to save a little bit of money here and there.
What about the? I think there was a $1.3 million one-time bonus they were going to spread out among county employees.
Yes.
That the commissioners promised. Is that going to be impacted by this?
No, it should not be impacted by that. They promised this earlier in the year. They say, you know, we may be having a bit of a hiccup right now, but these county workers, they haven't had a raise in a while. This is not a raise. This is a one-time thing. We're still going to do it sometime in the next couple of weeks. There's no cost of living adjustment. There's no merit pay, no general salary adjustment. It's just going to be, you know, here's a little bit of extra money to keep you going and perhaps improve morale in county offices.
Bill and Jay, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Coming up, Kentucky's governor is miffed over the scrutiny his mansion is coming under. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us now for a look at the news from Kentucky, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton, River City News Editor and Publisher Michael Monks, and Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ryland, Scott, and Michael, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Ryland, let's start with this story about the governor's mansion outside of Louisville. It's drawing scrutiny from the media. So what's going on here?
Oh, did we lose him?
We must have lost Ryland. Okay, but we'll pick up with this. This is a rather interesting story. He has a mansion outside of Louisville. I believe it's the Louisville Courier-Journal.
Yes.
And some of the local TV stations have really been digging into this.
Yeah, the question is whether Matt Bevin received a sweetheart deal on buying his rather large property in Anchorage, Kentucky, for political favors. And he says that no, it was a typical transaction. So the papers, the news media, particularly the Courier-Journal, has spent a lot of focus on the valuation of his house, which is, I've never seen so much attention on a property valuation before, but it's become quite interesting because the governor is now, he's getting really, really, really angry at the press for even just raising this question, and it's making it a lot more entertaining than I think it normally would be.
Yeah. So yeah, there was like a meeting this past week that they were, the property value people were there, and yes, a reporter.
So some kind of an assessment.
Yeah, exactly.
Going on.
Yeah, okay. To see if if the value matched how much he paid for it, and this was sold by a guy that he has since had appointed to a position in Frankfurt. So that's where the questions have arisen. But he took to Twitter, one of his preferred platforms, to argue. The reporters, they're stalking me. They knocked on my door, and there's drones involved.
Yeah, which is, Rylan, what is this about drones, by the way?
Well, there was a drone that was flying outside of the governor's mansion when this appeals board came through to review. They were kind of conducting another assessment of the governor's mansion just to kind of see if they wanted to change the assessed property value. And it actually, so he had fired off all these tweets at Courier Journal reporter Tom Loftus and also Wave 3 News, accusing them of flying a drone over his yard and filming his children. He's gotten into that.
So he's saying they're invading his privacy. Yeah.
Yes. And it turned out to be WDRB, the news director of WDRB, and he says he was flying the drone outside of the governor's house, outside of his property, and in accordance with FAA regulations. He's like a licensed drone pilot. He's saying this is a newsworthy story. He didn't have any footage of the governor's children, and the governor was kind of taking advantage of this moment to kind of lash out at the media. I should say there's some breaking news on this front. This appeals board that the governor had appealed his property value to, they just come out with a ruling like an hour ago, and awarded the governor. So the governor won. They say that his house is in fact not worth as much as the county had originally assessed it at. So somewhat vindicating the governor's position on this, that the county had overassessed. They had inflated the value of his home, and that the news media and these people who had filed complaints against him were didn't have the story right.
And Rylan, wasn't one of the arguments the governor was making that there was water damage to the house and the house needed some repairs?
Yeah, it's a really old house, and it was actually, so it's in this Louisville suburb of Anchorage, and it's called the Anchorage Place, which is actually, it's what Anchorage, this suburb, was named after. So it's been there for a really long time. And he's saying it's in disrepair. There's all this water damage. So even though it's historic, there's all these problems with it. And this all kind of, his attorneys were arguing this in this meeting last week. And reporters don't generally go to the Jefferson County Property Assessment Appeals Board, but it was packed with folks the governor's attorney.
No drones, though, right?
No drones inside the room. But said that there's considerable damage to the house, and evidently the appeals board agreed with them. They ended up going with the governor's private appraiser, who actually also is a former Jefferson County PVA. The governor went out.
It's the most dramatic property valuation I've ever seen. I mean, I've never seen an issue like this before.
I can't imagine. Meantime, the ACLU of Kentucky has filed a lawsuit against Governor Bevin. And Rylan, what's this about?
So the governor, he is one of many politicians who blocks people on Twitter and Facebook. President Trump also does this. And this is kind of it's a little bit of a new frontier in kind of First Amendment rights. Whether or not officials and politicians are allowed to block people from their official Twitter and Facebook accounts, and so the ACLU they found a couple plaintiffs, people who were blocked by the governor, and they say they hadn't really done anything wrong, that the governor had just blocked them because he disagreed with their views. The governor says they have a policy and they only block people who are making obscene comments or making off-topic comments. and that, you know, he welcomes, you know, a diverse debate. It's this wild west of First Amendment law. We don't really know how far this will go, but I think there is some unclarity here that needs resolution, whether or not, you know, whether or not this really constitutes as an official speech from, you know, say the state, when they're talking on Twitter and Facebook.
Ryland, do you think the governor kind of made it a public space when he is in his State of the State address and other addresses said, ignore newspapers and TV, get my message on my social media feeds on Facebook, on Twitter? So he's said in official statements that this is how I'm communicating with people. Doesn't that kind of change the playing field a little bit on this?
I think that that's a great point. The governor he's been a real media critic, kind of trying to define a new way of how information, the transfer of information between, you know, politicians, the state, and constituents happens. And yeah, he's been trying to subvert the media in the meantime. And yeah, it's, you know, if he's inviting one and all to get the information straight from the horse's mouth on these social media platforms, it's like, well, you know, shouldn't everybody be included in that, even some of your harshest critics?
Ryland, we've got an interesting political race that's shaping up in Kentucky's 6th Congressional District. And Michael, I think you wrote some about this too. Tell us about what's happening with this. This is the seat that's currently held by Andy Barr. And Michael, we'll start with you. Give us an overview on this.
Amy McGrath is running for the Democratic nomination to face Republican Andy Barr out of the Kentucky 6th in Congress. And that is a district that includes Lexington and the surrounding counties around there. So just south of Northern Kentucky. But she is a Notre Dame Academy graduate.
Right. She's former Kentucky native. She's a Kenton County native.
Yeah. So she came out with a campaign ad announcing her candidacy, and it blew up all over the place. She's a Marine, so she's got that military background, and she's been referred to as sort of a dream Democratic candidate, the type of tough-talking, smart person that the Democrats would love to put up against candidates like Andy Barr. It was really interesting to watch the reaction in Northern Kentucky. Northern Kentucky is represented by a Republican, Thomas Massey, and usually there's not a very serious Democratic challenger. So there was actually a lot of excitement because of her connection to Notre Dame, and probably confusion that she was challenging the 4th District congressman and not the 6th District. So you saw a lot of Democratic voters up here saying that they couldn't wait to vote for her, but the only way they're going to do that is if they move to Lexington.
Right. Now, how have previous attempts to unseat Barr fared, Ryland?
Not well. Andy Barr unseated Ben Chandler a while back ago. I can't remember the year now. Democrats have really been unable to field a very competitive candidate in the 6th District for the past while, which is a little unusual because, I mean, the 6th District was, you know, drawn by Kentucky Democrats way back. It was fully a while ago expected to be a very strong Democratic district. Not also, you know, has Lexington in it, the second biggest city in Kentucky, which consistently votes for Democrats. Andy Barr's been held onto the seat for a long time, and so Democrats have been biting at the bit to try and get it back. McGrath seems like this candidate that can, you know, maybe pick up a little bit of both sides, a centrist, somebody who's got veteran experience, which is something that Democrats have been looking for in these national races across the country, and she says she wasn't recruited by the Democratic Party, but she certainly does fit into this mold that they're looking for as they're trying to kind of capitalize on people who oppose kind of a little bit of the craziness, the wild tone that has been adopted, you know, by the White House and just kind of the disarray that Congress is in right now. It'll be interesting to see if this congressional district, if it is competitive, but it certainly hasn't been for the past few election cycles.
Does she have to go through a primary first, Ryland?
Oh yeah, she'll be running in a primary next year. So far, State Senator Reggie Thomas has declared. He declared about a month, I think, before McGrath did. They both say that they're looking forward to having a competitive race. Thomas had nudged at her you know, saying welcome to the district. She just recently moved to Georgetown in the 6th District after, you know, 20 years serving in the Marines. So, you know, and also, you know, her upbringing in Northern Kentucky. So he was trying to jab at her, you know, that, you know, she's a carpetbagger coming in to, you know, just take advantage of this district, which she sees as more competitive.
And as long as we're talking politics, Fancy Farm is this weekend, right?
Yes. Yeah, as far as I know.
You've actually, I assume Ryland has too. Scott, you've been to one of these. What are these like?
Well, I mean, it's a very loud environment. It's
raucous.
It's been touted as, although I think it's kind of less so nowadays, because it's been touted as one of the only places you can see politicians like going both barrels, insulting each other, old style stump speeches. But I think nowadays Facebook and Twitter,
they're kind of roasting each other. Is that what they're doing?
Yes, yes. Okay. But that's kind of like every day now with Facebook and Twitter. So yeah. I don't know if it's the event that it used to be. I know this year there really aren't too many big names. So I don't think there is as much anticipation this year. Maybe Rowling, you can speak to this a bit, but it doesn't seem like there is as much anticipation this year. I mean, it is a off year election wise. There are no elections in Kentucky. So there isn't as much anticipation this year.
Yeah, I'm down here in Western Kentucky now in anticipation of it. I've been the last few years. And it's a off-year election-wise, but they're still expected to be a big crowd, especially from this area. It's kind of the one time of the year in which Western Kentucky's West Kentucky is you know, kind of thrown into the forefront of the political stage, and so people really come out in droves for this, and it's not only a political speaking event, it's a big old barbecue event too. But there will still be people and some interesting things to look for. Congressman Jamie Comer is coming back, got a little bit of a homecoming for him. He's adopted he's had some kind of interesting things he's been pushing for, including like lifting the trade embargo on Cuba in his freshman term in Congress. And people, he's pretty popular in this part of the state. And then we'll see a showdown between House Speaker Jeff Hoover and the House Minority Leader Rocky Atkins, who are both these kind of, very good and loud stump speakers. So that'll be a fun thing to watch. But yeah,
so this is an event that's perfect for them. Yeah,
it is a perfect event for them. And it's kind of, there's this lately in recent years, Fancy Farm's gotten this, the tone and tenor of it's gotten a little bit louder and nastier as the years go on, it seems. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when this isn't a, you know, there's no big election right in front of us. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of kind of Republicans dunking on Democrats over the recent, you know, shellacking in legislative races and other races. But Democrats will make a showing. And, you know, this used to be a huge Democratic bloc here in Kentucky, Western Kentucky did. So they'll try to be digging into their old populist roots to see if they still have some supporters out here.
Ryland, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Now, Michael and Scott, Covington's just been through a violent stretch. We've had four people shot. Two of them were killed. This is near the intersection of 13th and Wheeler.
Yes.
Okay. And is there any idea if these shootings were related in any way, shape, or form?
The police are saying they don't know if there's a connection or what the motive is, but a lot of the residents say that they think that the shootings are unrelated. There are a lot of young people that hang out at this corner. There's a convenience store there. And evidently there have been incidents, violent incidents there in the past. And so they just said it just happens to be this street corner that's a problem. But the events themselves aren't necessarily related.
Michael, what's been the community reaction?
Well, very sad. You know, this is over a stretch of 4 days, you had two double shootings, and two people were killed, one in each of those shootings. So there was a community gathering on Wednesday to commemorate and try to rally support to end the violence that's taken place over there. This is a part of the neighborhood that used to be a lot more violent in the late 90s in particular, but they created some reforms, the police did, to attack that. They've made 13th Street a one-way street, for example, and their patrols have been upped. But you know, when the weather is warmer, people come out more and they gather there. And that is the intersection where there's just any time of day that you go by there, particularly in the summer, you're going to see large crowds. So the police and city leadership have implored anyone with information. This has been the big challenge for them, is to get any information from the people. There were a lot of witnesses in both these cases.
And they have no suspects that we know of so far.
They have not released any public information about who they might be looking for. And that's what we're waiting on. And they, to see the police chief and the prosecutor and the mayor all to stand before the media and say, please come forward with information, because no one has.
They said there are a lot of people in the neighborhood that have been well-meaning and try to give information that they want, but the people that were actually on the scene, which they said there were for both shootings, a group of people there, but those people aren't coming forward.
Meantime, Covington has a new city manager.
Yeah, they've gone out west for their new manager. David Johnston has been hired out.
Tell us about him here, Michael.
Well, what we know is he's a professional manager. He's been all over the country at a few different stops in an administrator role. So he's very well educated. I think he's had a long career. He's about 60 years old, I think. And he's joining from a suburb of Seattle. And he's expected to start before August 23rd. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the second choice. The first guy they offered the job to declined. We don't know exactly why, but this guy's coming in and he'll start by the end of the month. And we look forward to seeing how he fits into this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he gets along with the rest of the commission. One of the commissioners admitted that it's not the easiest commission to work with. So we'll...
You've seen a lot of people leave the city building since just prior to the change and after. So that will be interesting to see. It's also worth noting that there's been an interim city manager since February who's been making about $11,000 a month. And then they also had to pay the city manager they fired for an additional 5 months. Mm-hmm. So they are paying about $20,000 a month for the past 5 or 6 months. And this new guy is going to be making more than both of them ever did at $140,000. So after 18 months or so, the city of Covington would have paid about $250,000 in salaries to the three city managers that they've had in that period of
time.
City
managers aren't cheap.
No, they are not. Bellevue is getting a new Waffle House, Michael.
Huge story, man. Huge story.
And you sit there and you think, oh, we've only got a couple of minutes left to go over this, but you might think, well, what's the big deal? Yeah. But this is actually turning out to be quite interesting.
Well, it is Waffle House. And you know, anytime you get to write about a new restaurant opening, even if it's a national chain, and I'm sure Scott can attest to this, and you guys can too with your site, it usually does well. It's like easy clicks. People are always interested in what's coming to town and what's interesting to eat. But you will never find a community like Bellevue where people are so well-versed in the city's zoning policy. And Bellevue several years ago adopted what is known as form-based code, which is an effort to create a more pedestrian friendly area. And this is near the Kroger in Bellevue along Donnermeyer Drive. So a lot of you may be familiar with Fairfield Avenue, which is a popular shopping, historic shopping district. This is just a couple blocks south of that. And it looks more suburban and they're trying to urbanize it. And so there is a Waffle House coming, but it had to seek some permission for some adaptations to fit the form-based code. The interesting component here, though, and the reason that I thought we should talk about it, is they have to get permission from Kroger. They're going to need access to Kroger's parking in order to accommodate their customers, or they'll have to violate the form-based code and put another curb cut in. And Kroger was denied, because of the form-based code, the opportunity to put a fuel center on this very site.
Ouch.
Yeah, so that's the great irony here. So we will see if Kroger has any old wounds, or if they're gonna play nice with the new Waffle House and allow them the access.
And real quickly, Newport just amended its zoning for a parcel at 9th and Saratoga. What's happening here?
Yeah, I think Scott and I both watched the City Commission talk about this recently. There's a couple of historic buildings at the corner of 9th and Saratoga. I think this would be the southwest corner of 9th and Saratoga. There's an architect developer who's going to come in and put what's a really cool design, but it is very, very contemporary and very modern. And so some historic preservationists are concerned about taking these buildings and placing what may not fit historically in that neighborhood.
Newport, though, in the last few years, they have a lot of new buildings that the housing authority there has put up. And so that you have a lot of new and old that has gone in that city for the last few years.
Infill's always tricky in historic districts, and you can see bad infill, and you can see some infill that does not try to conform to historic design at all. This one certainly doesn't, although I believe it is called the Ellen and Lofts, which is a reference to the historic train tracks that ran through Saratoga.
Michael and Scott, thanks for joining us this afternoon. River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks and Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier with help from Jim Nolan. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Rick Andrus was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.